Hello and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you eat, move, think, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle medicine pioneer with over 25 years of clinical experience in patient-centered care. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Peter Grinspoon to talk about cannabis, what it can help with, what the risks are, and what you should know about its use. Dr. Peter Grinspoon and I trained through residency together. He's a primary care physician and a cannabis specialist at Massachusetts General Hospital and an instructor in medicine at Harvard Medical School. He's the author of the book, Seeing Through Smoke, A Cannabis Expert Untangles the Truth About Marijuana. He's a TEDx speaker, a certified physician life coach, a board member of the physician advocacy group, Doctors for Drug Policy Reform, and an advisor to the Parabola Center. He is the author of the groundbreaking memoir, Free Refills, A Doctor Confronts His Addiction. He's frequently cited in the national media as a thought leader on cannabis, psychedelics, drugs of misuse, and addiction, and has bylines in Time, Newsweek, CNN, Salon, Truthdig, Reason, The Nation, Psychiatric Times, Stat, The Boston Globe, The LA Times, and MedPage Today. Peter, it's great having you on this podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Peter, how did you get interested in cannabis?
Well, I've been involved with medical cannabis my whole life. Number one, my dad was a very famous cannabis scholar at Harvard Medical School. He wrote a book in 1971 calling for legalization, where at that point only 12% of Americans supported legalization. Now, like 94% support legal access to medical marijuana. So he was way ahead of his time. But more sort of poignantly, my brother Danny fought an unsuccessful battle with childhood leukemia. And my parents bought him medical marijuana in the early 1970s, and it really helped him in the last year of his life eat, keep food down, not be nauseous and vomiting all the time. When he didn't use cannabis, he'd be lying alone in his bedroom like he's 16, throwing up. And when he did use cannabis, he'd be like eating, playing his guitar, most importantly to me, playing with his little brothers. So I saw firsthand that it could be really helpful, and I've been interested in it for my entire medical career, which is exactly as long as your entire medical career, because we trained together.
Exactly. Peter, how old were you when your brother was sick?
Oh, I was like 8. But it was interesting, you know, the smell of cannabis, I came to associate with like healing, because like my brother would smoke it and come down and be able to like have a sandwich and hang out with us, as opposed to being like lying in his bed. So it just was a really, there's nothing more impactful than seeing the alleviation of suffering with a close family member.
Yeah. I could imagine, and I'm sorry to hear that. And throughout your profession, tell me a bit more about how you have studied it, incorporated it into your medical practice.
Well, it was interesting. In my senior presentation at the Brigham, you know, in the year 2000, I presented on medical cannabis. And everybody thought, nobody was against it, but everybody thought it was sort of eccentric. And this is really interesting. 24 years later, you know, it's legal in like 40 states. It's legal recreationally in half the states. More than half of people live in a state where it's legal to just go out and buy cannabis. And it's a lot more accepted now than it was. But the interesting thing is it never really stopped being a medicine. It's been used for thousands of years. And it was used in the United States in the late 1800s and early 1900s. There were more than 100 scientific papers about cannabis in this country. And then when they went to criminalize it in 1937, the group most vociferously opposed to making it illegal was the American Medical Association. They testified, why would you take away this medicine that we could use? And then it's been rapidly becoming back into favor, you know, over the last 10, 20, 30 years. And it has been pretty successful. You know, I have a lot to say about this, but I just view cannabis as like any other medication. It works for some people. It doesn't work for other people. Some people shouldn't use it. And it's just another tool we have in our toolbox.
And I want to circle back in a second to who can use it, what to use it for. But you mentioned the American Medical Association. What's the history of medicine and marijuana? Because it seems now it's carte blanche, not really well received in the medical community. And there's probably a long history behind that. How did we get here?
Well, again, doctors were very much in favor of it in the 1920s, 1930s. And then there was this really brutal war on drugs, starting in like 1937 when they criminalized cannabis with the Marijuana Tax Act, but then up and through the Nixon administration. And there was just so much negative propaganda against it. I think that you know, my chapter in my book is called Do Me No Harm. It's about how doctors are on the wrong side of the entire war on drugs, not just the war on cannabis, and just for sort of buying all the propaganda hook, line, and sinker. And the government really needed to taint and stigmatize cannabis to wage their war on drugs, you know, which we have the highest incarceration rate of any other country. And a lot of that's just based on drug-related charges, you know, not just cannabis, but crack cocaine, that whole thing. So most of the research was intended to show that it is harmful, not beneficial. Like to get cannabis research in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, you had to show a drop in something, a drop in IQ, a drop in motivation, a drop in sperm count, none of which are actually true. There are harms, but not those. But now in the last 10 years or so, the research is a lot more two-sided, especially in other countries like Israel, Europe, Canada. They're really studying not let's show the cannabis is harmful, but is cannabis harmful or helpful, and how can we use it helpfully? So I think now that doctors are getting exposed to more broad research, not just the drug war nonsense that unfortunately we've been subject to for so long. And then the final thing I say, what I've noticed is that what a given doctor tends to think about medical marijuana or cannabis tends a little bit to do with their vantage point. On the one hand, you look at oncologists. They see their patients with cancer doing well, getting some relief. Something like 90% of oncologists are in favor of medical marijuana on the polls that I've seen. And then on the other extreme is a pediatric or adolescent psychiatrist who see the rare but really tragic cases of like a young person smoking cannabis, and that helps trigger or destabilize them into psychosis. And they tend to be really against it. Primary care doctors, about two-thirds of them at this point, are in favor of it. They think it can be a helpful medication for people. So doctors are really all over the place, but I think it depends a little bit on their vantage point.
That's fair and very understandable. What are good uses or ways that the cannabis can actually be helpful that is evidence-based? You know, it seems like there's so much clouding in the literature.
Right. The main one is chronic pain, and it absolutely helps people with chronic pain. It helps dull the pain, and it also helps affect the part of your brain that is responsible for perception of pain or perceiving pain as a noxious sensation. So people say that they have pain, but they're not quite, you know, as distressed by it. Another thing that makes it hard to study cannabis is that it affects like three or four different things at once. Like if a patient has fibromyalgia, very difficult thing to treat. It can affect the pain, the perception of pain, the anxiety, the insomnia, the anxiety about having pain or untreated pain. And in other countries such as Israel, they use cannabis as a first-line treatment for a condition such as fibromyalgia. So the main thing I use it for is chronic pain, but certainly people with multiple sclerosis, with like their spasticity and their bladder irritability, it helps them. It helps people with insomnia. And it's hard to argue that something like Ambien is safer than something like a little bit of medical cannabis. So, and a lot of people use it for anxiety. Whether the anxiety gets better over time when they use cannabis, gets worse or stays the same can be true for any other medications we use for anxiety. So I'm not sure that cannabis actually cures any of these things, but it certainly helps people with the symptoms, and it often helps people with the symptoms less toxically or in a less toxic fashion. I shouldn't make up words. In a less toxic fashion than many of the traditional pharmaceuticals.
And when you say chronic pain conditions, you mentioned fibromyalgia. Would you use it for like osteoarthritis and other conditions?
Cannabis is not good for severe pain. It's just not that strong. So like post-surgical or broken bone or someone has like failed back syndrome, you're going to need an opiate. But for the mild to moderate pain that is becoming an aging society as we get a little bit portlier, you know, our knees or backs or hips hurt, instead of taking like ibuprofen after ibuprofen, which, you know, is over the counter but can kill your kidneys, cause ulcers and heart attacks, I would say a little bit of cannabis is a lot safer and very effective, especially if you don't smoke it. It used to be that people smoked it, and the smoking is not healthy because you get combustion products, tar, benzene, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. But if you take a little bit of an edible or a tincture under your tongue, it's very benign, you know, as long as you're not, which we'll talk about, you know, one of the categories of people cannabis is more dangerous for, such as teenagers or pregnant women.
Right. And so, yes, you brought up a couple really important things to touch on. So if a person is going to use it for pain, then the best ways are not to smoke it and to use it, like you said, as a tincture or
a little piece of an edible. You know, and as long as you start low and go slow, the last thing you want to do is start with a huge dose of cannabis because it causes anxiety if you take too much. It's an absolutely miserable experience. Believe me, in my college days, been there, done that. And like nobody wants to take too much cannabis. It's just not fun. But if you start a patient on a very teeny dose explained to them it's going to take weeks to get you up to the right dose. We're going to slowly, gently get your way up. You start with a drop under the tongue. Next night, a couple drops. Next night, maybe three drops. And it'll take them weeks to get up to the right dose. They might say it doesn't work. They might say, I don't like the feeling, but they're not going to have a bad experience. So just opt for something else.
And Peter, you have so much experience prescribing it. Most people visiting their physician, I imagine, may not get the same guidance. What's a good way for people who are interested in using it for pain to know how to do it, to get the most out of it with the least side effect?
Right. Well, first of all, the answer is to educate doctors, because every poll shows that most people want to get their information about cannabis from their doctors. But only about 3% do, and most of them go to their bud tenders, the people that work at the dispensary. And the problem with that is they're not medically trained at all. You know, they're like, oh, my cousin tried this for their migraine at a Grateful Dead concert 8 years ago, so why don't you try this? It's not like the most scientific process. So really, the solution is going to be educating doctors. But there are some pretty good resources. That's part of why I wrote my book, which came out on 420 last year, Seeing Through the Smoke, to try to give people a little bit of context and perspective and sort of a little bit of hands-on knowledge and information. But generally speaking, if you start with a very low dose and just sneak your way up very slowly, you're not going to get into trouble. And you just don't want to start with a huge dose because, for example, a puff is like 5 to 10 milligrams. I start people on 1 or 2 milligrams. There's absolutely no way you could get in trouble with like 1 milligram. It's like a fifth to a tenth of a puff of marijuana. And then you work your way up really over 3 weeks. So I would just say, people have been doing this for thousands of years. It's pretty easy. One of the things that makes it more complicated is that the products are so strong and you don't want to accidentally overconsume. But as long as you start really gently, you're going to be fine.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So one puff is like 5 times what you'd recommend as the starting amount.
When I was growing up, you know, cannabis was like 3-4%. Now it's like 20-25%. People get in trouble with it. Like people take the same 3 bong hits they took in college now that it's legal, and they don't realize that instead of it being 3%, it's like 24%, and they just freak out and have an awful experience. I'm always the one at the party that gets called to deal with people like this. So, you know, I just urge people to just really start with just a teeny bit, especially if you haven't done it for 40 years.
Yeah. And what are side effects? So you mentioned if a person gets too much, they can get anxiety. Are there side effects if a person starts to use it daily for pain management?
Well, first of all, I don't think it works very well if you use it all the time. It's like, I know we're going to talk about the endocannabinoid system, but we have these natural cannabinoid receptors in our brains, and we have natural cannabis-like molecules modulating a whole host of activities like memory, learning, reproduction, feeding, temperature, hunger. And if you smoke cannabis all the time, your natural cannabinoid receptors become thinner and sparser, and it makes it so that you have to use more and more cannabis to get the same effect. So I don't think it's very effective at all to use it all the time. You have these patients that puff on their vape pens every 10 minutes, and I don't think it does anything. So I think that if people really, just like with any other medication, we try to use the lowest effective dose. If they try to keep their doses at a modest level, it works a lot better. I mean, the other side effects, you shouldn't drive after using it. It's not as dangerous as alcohol. It's about as dangerous as all the other medications we tell people not to drive on and they ignore us, like opiates and benzos and antihistamines and gabapentinoids and muscle relaxants. But we absolutely tell people not to drive, not to use if you're pregnant, because there's concern, not definitive proof, but concern about the effects on the fetus and on the child as they grow up. And we don't want teenagers using it, except, you know, worried about brain development, except under certain circumstances. If they're dying of cancer, like my brother Danny, of course, let them use cannabis. It's the humane thing to do. And then, you know, it can be impairing, you know, so you don't want to do it when you have to work or you're in charge of your children. And the other side effects are pretty benign. It can cause a temporary psychosis, as can steroids, amphetamines, hallucinogens, alcohol, but that's really rare. But aside from really rare side effects, it is generally pretty benign if used, you know, in a safe and, you know, conservative manner.
If one of your patients is using it on a regular basis, is there any lab monitoring? Like you mentioned with Aleve or ibuprofen, you may check kidney or liver. Do you do any type of monitoring with cannabis use?
With CBD, you might check liver tests if they use a lot of CBD because, you know, Aleve is now an FDA-approved medication, which is just CBD for childhood epilepsy syndromes. And in the studies for that, Aleve, when taken with medications like valproate, did cause a little bit of liver inflammation. It's unclear whether CBD by itself. The other thing about CBD is that it interacts. CBD is just the second most common component of cannabis. The most common is THC, which gets people high. CBD is used by tons of people. One in three Americans have tried it for chronic pain, anxiety, and insomnia. Now, CBD works just like grapefruit juice. It can compete for the liver enzymes and raise the level of other medications in your blood because they don't get cleared as efficiently. So if you're on like a medication that has to be within a narrow therapeutic window, like an anti-epileptic, an immunosuppressant, an anticoagulant, then I would do laboratory testing, maybe of the liver test, but certainly of your Coumadin level, just to make sure you're not getting too much. But for the medical marijuana itself, there's no laboratory testing that you need to do. You just want to be aware of like the CBD, the drug interactions, and just really close follow-up is important. I think in this case, the clinical follow-up is the most important thing. I always encourage people to email me a week or two after and let me know how they're doing. We can titrate the dose. Are they feeling anxious? Are they getting relief? So I really think like coherent doctor-patient communication is the key to this working really well. Of course, that's true for all medications and drugs, but I think particularly for cannabis, because there's so much contradictory information on the internet. Like anything you look up about cannabis, you will find two equally seemingly credible, diametrically opposed answers about any question you ask. So for that reason, I think a coherent follow-up and communication with the caregivers is really, really critical.
In states where marijuana is legal for recreational use and people have the choice between CBD and marijuana, and they are trying to manage whether it's pain, anxiety, or insomnia, do you have any thoughts or recommendations of one versus the other?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of marketing around different strains and types of cannabis. I actually think a lot of it's nonsense. You know, they all have the same descriptions. You go into a dispensary and they all say, causes a energizing, euphoric, cerebral high, followed by a relaxing, full body calm. I just think there's a lot of nonsense. They categorize it in terms of sativas and indicas, but that's not even accurate as well, because sativas are more uplifting and indicas, indica couch, are more relaxing, better for pain. You're more vegetable eating Doritos happily. But, you know, they've really hybridized a lot of the indicas and sativas over the last 20 years. It's because of the war on drugs. The sativas are these really tall plants that could be seen from the air during Reagan's crackdown. So everybody's getting arrested. So they hybridized it with these short, scrubby indicas so that now what we get is mostly a hybrid. If you go to a dispensary, someone will say the word sativa to indicate something that might help you with your focus, your energy, or to go out. So you want to go to a party. Whereas indica is relaxing, indica couch, mellow, good for pain, good for appetite. So they do denote these two general categories, but it's not a botanical difference anymore. And there definitely are different strains. Keep in mind that cannabis is really complicated. There are 500 different molecules in it, many of which are psychoactive. There are 100 different molecules that affect our cannabinoid receptors. So it stands to reason that different mixtures of it would have different effects on us. The problem is, it's really difficult for patients to know what to do based on the fact their doctors don't know anything, and the bud tenders are often like, don't have the most strict medical background. So it's really hard for people to get good information about like what types of cannabis do what. This will get better once we legalize it and there's much better labeling and there are standards and there's a standard dose and standard packaging and you could know I get this amount of this, this amount of that. It'll get much better once we get federal legalization. It's a weird situation where each state has a different sort of organizational system and the legality is different state by state. And you know, again, most people live in a place where they have medical marijuana, but it would be much more coherent if there were just national standards, standard dose, standard labeling. I can't wait for that day. It'll make my life a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Well, like you said, since your dad's time until now, there's been so much progress. That will be maybe your work over your lifetime.
Hopefully. I mean, you know, honestly, there have been 20 million arrests for nonviolent cannabis possession over the last 50 years. You know, and mostly people with dark skin. Blacks and whites use cannabis at the same rate, but there are four times as many arrests with blacks. And, you know, it affects your employment, your education, your student loans, your housing if you get a drug arrest. And why criminalize something that people do anyways? Like the rates aren't going up with legalization. It's just the product's safer. Massachusetts had more tax revenue from cannabis than alcohol last year, like much more. I mean, I'm sort of an outlier in that I sort of think that like, law enforcement isn't the way to go with any drugs. I mean, if people are addicted, they need treatment. They don't need to get arrested. But particularly with cannabis, which is non-lethal, there's never been an overdose death from cannabis.
That's interesting. And you mentioned with the cannabis use that from state to state, there are a lot of variations. How about with CBD? I find that that's also very difficult because knowing what product you're getting, like the...
The problem with CBD is that there's no adult in the room. It's not regulated at all, like zero regulation. Mm-hmm. So they do test after test where they buy CBD products off the shelf. And like some of them have no CBD. Most of them have either much less or much more than they say, usually much less. And some of them have THC. Like the last thing you want to do is take THC when you think you're taking CBD and have to drive home or be in charge of your kids. So what the companies do to kind of partially alleviate this is they do their own independent laboratory testing. So when you buy CBD, you should get a COA or certificate of analysis proving that there's independent laboratory testing and that that product has whatever it says it has in it. But again, that would be much better if the FDA just regulated it. Of course, you know, it's like a $40 billion industry. 1 in 7 Americans are taking a CBD product as we speak. And I don't know how the FDA is going to regulate it because they already have a drug, Epulidex, that's an FDA-approved medication. And I can't think of any other situation where you have a medication that's approved and something can, people could just buy at the supermarket. It is a very strange situation. But somebody needs to regulate not just the CBD, but all these hemp-derived products. The 2018 Farm Bill legalized all the products from CBD. And then people are discovering like all these things that are just like cannabis, but not quite. And they're legal, like Delta 8, Delta 10 THC, HHC, all these other synthetic cannabinoids. And what's really dangerous about this is, again, nobody's regulating it. So first of all, people tend to use these synthetic cannabinoids in states where cannabis isn't legal. People would rather use cannabis. But if you can't get cannabis, you just go to a smoke shop and get Delta 8 instead of Delta 9, but nobody's regulating the Delta 8. You don't know what's in it, if they're heavy metals. So again, with some sensible regulation, CBD and all the hemp-derived products would be much safer for everybody.
And for products that you can simply just get at a grocery store, like hemp seeds, for example, is there any effect from a dose that low, or is that just too low an amount?
Too low a dose. Actually, marijuana seeds are usually legal. They're part of bird seed. They're very nutritious, but they don't have any THC in them. So people don't really make the seeds legal. You can eat a trailer park full of seeds and not get high. So I don't think they really worry about the seeds as much. But it's a very low dose. You know, the only difference between hemp and cannabis is the amount of THC. They're the same plant. The only difference is that hemp is less than 0.3% THC and cannabis is more than 0.3% THC. Of course, everybody wants to replace tobacco, which is dying, with hemp. There's no way to tell if it's hemp or cannabis. They can't tell unless you send it to a lab, which takes weeks. So they have a hard time enforcing it. But it's really a pretty minor difference between the two plants.
Mm-hmm. And Peter, you touched on the endocannabinoid system, which I think is also very fascinating because it's only been a few decades since that system's been discovered. Are there natural ways that we can kind of support the endocannabinoid system?
Absolutely. Exercise. You know, they used to think runner's high was mediated by endorphins. Now they think it's mediated by endocannabinoids. Healthy diet, meditation, mindfulness, all these things have been linked to like a higher endocannabinoid tone. And, you know, it's interesting. The reason people have withdrawal when they stop cannabis abruptly, a lot of cannabis advocates say there's no addiction, there's no withdrawal. There's definitely addiction and there's definitely withdrawal. It might have been exaggerated a little bit during the war on drugs, but definitely. And the reason people have such bad withdrawal symptoms is because, as I mentioned before, our natural cannabinoid receptors thin out if we bombard them all the time by smoking cannabis. And then all of a sudden you stop the external cannabis from coming in. Your natural cannabinoid receptors have the same amount of these molecules, but many fewer receptors. So the withdrawal symptoms are like the opposite of what you get from smoking cannabis. People can't eat, they can't sleep, and they get really stressed out and grumpy. So again, in moderation, we could avoid a lot of this, but it's easier to educate and to regulate and to moderate, I think, as it's legal and that it's all, you know, it shouldn't be something that people are embarrassed to talk about with their doctors or afraid of getting into trouble. If you give them the wrong incentives, they'll just clam up and you'll never even hear about it. So whatever we could do to foster open communication, I'm a big fan.
And you know, there's always concern, at least it comes up a lot about, is cannabis addictive?
It absolutely can be addictive. You know, it causes euphoria. Anything that causes euphoria can cause addiction. Now, it's really interesting. The way they defined cannabis use disorder in the DSM-5 is overly inclusive. It's like completely broken. They use tolerance and withdrawal as two different qualifiers. And you just need 2 out of 11. So if you have tolerance and withdrawal, you're addicted to cannabis. And that's obviously not true. A lot of the medical marijuana patients have tolerance and withdrawal, and they're doing just fine. They're not addicted. We don't include tolerance and withdrawal in our definition of like addiction to medical opiates or addiction to medical benzodiazepines, because everybody who uses opiates or benzodiazepines, or your SSRI for that matter, has tolerance and withdrawal. That does not constitute an addiction.
Well, so does coffee. Yeah,
absolutely. Coffee is way more addictive than cannabis. I talk a lot about that in my book. But the fact is, you harm someone when you give them a diagnosis of addiction, which they don't have. They've studied this extensively. People see the word addiction, and then you don't get pain medications. You don't get treated as well. So I think we need to redefine cannabis addiction in a way that actually captures the people that are addicted, but doesn't rope in all the medical patients who are doing well. That said, cannabis addiction, you know, it can be people don't achieve their goals. They tend to be very isolated. It can be a very, very miserable experience. And like any other addiction, it needs to be treated with compassion, skill, and empathy. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't take cannabis addiction seriously. Again, if you exaggerate things, then no one's going to believe you and you lose your credibility. It's like, we just tell the truth about these things, everybody will believe us. So I think cannabis can be quite addictive, but it's not 30% of adults who use it like some of the addiction psychiatrists claim. And it does need to be treated. And I don't think either side's right about this. I think it certainly can be addictive, but it's not as addictive. I mean, the other thing is that like I've been addicted to opiates. I'm 17 years in recovery from my opiate addiction. And I've helped a lot of other doctors get over their opiate addictions. And I can tell you that it's not quite the same addiction. Like nobody's breaking into pharmacies or like injuring themselves to get cannabis like they would opiates. It's not like, it doesn't destroy your life as thoroughly as opiate addiction does. And you can't die from overdosing cannabis. But that said, it can be miserable and it needs to be recognized and treated.
And, you know, our conversation is mainly focusing on adults, and you touched on it's different for young people. Is there an age at which you think it can have adverse effects on kids?
Well, I always advocate for 18 or above. You know, some of the addiction people advocate for 25 and above. But of course, it's not as dangerous as alcohol. So what are we going to do, raise the alcohol limit to 25? Like, it doesn't make any sense. So I sort of tend to be a pragmatist. Like, it's certainly you don't want your 15-year-olds getting high. It can affect their brain development. As they get older, their brains sort of cut down on all the connections. They prune, and cannabis can interfere with the pruning. And it's never really been shown to lower IQ, but it's not something you want teenagers to do. And the other thing is, teenagers are more likely to get addicted than adults because they don't learn to self-soothe. They're bored, they're angry, they're depressed, they're lonely. They grab their vape pen and they feel a little bit better. And they learn to do that instead of learning to ask for a hug or to talk to someone or to go for a walk. So there are a lot of reasons we don't want teenagers to use cannabis. We say, just say wait. You could make a very good argument for 18 because most of the damage absolutely is before 18. You can make an argument for 21, make it consistent with the drinking age. Of course, then that criminalizes all the college students that are going to do it anyway. So what's the purpose of that, in my opinion? And you can make a biological argument for age 25. But again, I think that's just very unrealistic in the same way it's unrealistic for alcohol and other substances. The reason age 25 is because that's technically when the brain stops developing.
I mean, there's no hope for us.
Unless you do psychedelics, right, and reopen your social learning network, and there's...
Hey, all this continued learning I'm doing, Peter. For people listening who are interested in either using CBD or cannabis, is there anything you want to share that we haven't had a chance to touch on?
Well, yeah. If you have a family history or personal history of psychosis, cannabis is a lot more dangerous because it can trigger people into psychosis. It doesn't really do it very much if you don't have a family history. But so if like your brother has schizophrenia, you would use cannabis very cautiously, if at all. Or if you had a psychotic episode when you're in college, even if you're like 50, you want to use it like very cautiously, if at all. The other thing is, a ton of pregnant women are using it now because it's really effective for morning sickness. And they think because it's natural, it's safe. And we just don't know if it's safe or not in pregnancy. Now, pregnancy is really complicated because you can't just ignore a pregnant woman who has a severe migraine. You have to give her something. And nothing else we would give her, we really want to give her in pregnancy either, like an opiate or a non-steroidal. So it's very difficult to know what to do. I don't recommend cannabis during pregnancy unless it's less toxic than whatever else we'd be given.
Well, thank you, Peter. Thanks for sharing everything that you've shared. And I'm sure your patients benefit so much from all the knowledge that you have. So thank you for the work that you do. And thank you for all the information you've shared.
Well, thanks for having me. A great conversation. Let's do another one on psychedelics in the future.
That sounds great. Well, thanks so much, Peter. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.